You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
First Nations listeners are advised that the following program may contain the names and voices of our mob who have passed on to the dreaming.
Hello, listeners. You're listening to Yilliman on 3CR, 855 AM in your dial. 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen on demand on Spotify, Apple Music, and wherever else you get your podcast from. So today we're going to be talking a little bit about violence. In particular, we're going to be talking a bit about how we contextualize violence and understand the nature of revolutionary self-defense. Now, just a trigger warning for, or content warning, whatever you want to call it, for any of the listeners out there today. We are going to be discussing, lightly touching on acts of violence, and we're going to be discussing violence itself, which some viewers or listeners, I should say, might find a little bit distressing. In particular, we're going to be talking about stuff like state violence. If any of that makes you uncomfortable, just a bit of a content warning for today's episode.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
So today we're talking a little bit about, how we contextualize violence, in particular the violence of the state and self-defense against that violence. Now, I really want to start here by saying that, this episode and what we're about to discuss, we're not going to be condoning nor condemning violence. We're just going to be talking about it so we can understand it a bit better. Now, to start off with, I want to, talk a bit about how we define violence. So, across the world, when we have revolutionary movements, they're quite often met with accusations of violence. Now, these accusations tend to focus on acts of resistance, whether these acts be physical, cultural, or political, all the while overlooking or excusing the structural violence that provokes these acts in the first place. Now, in colonized context, this is especially true. The violence of the settler state is rarely acknowledged as a form of violence at all. Now, here in the Australian context, First Nations people continue to experience some of the highest rates of incarceration, of child removal, of poverty, homelessness, premature death, a whole bunch of, sicknesses and illnesses. And, these are some of the highest, if not the highest, rates in the entire world. These conditions, they're not natural, they're not coincidental. They are the direct outcomes of systems and policies that are built to maintain control over our lands, our resources, and our people. When we talk about state violence, we need to understand that it's not limited to police shootings or deaths in custody, although these are very clear and undeniable examples. But state violence, it also includes stuff like the everyday violence of disconnection from country, the criminalization of our culture, stuff like the forced removal of our children, and the deliberate underfunding of Indigenous health, housing, and education. These are acts of harm that are embedded in law and policy, and they're carried out over generations. Now, despite this, resistance to such conditions is often labelled as being violent, while the conditions themselves are very often treated as neutral or as just a unfortunate byproduct of the system. Now, this framing reverses the role of the aggressor and the defender. It allows the state to present itself as something that is peaceful, even as it engages in a system that harms and displaces us. Now, on today's episode, we're going to be exploring this a bit more. In particular, we're going to explore the ways in which colonial states engage in sustained structural violence and how First Nations resistance including, you know, forms of revolutionary self-defense, emerges as a direct response to the reality that we live in. Now, I want to also, you know, just highlight again here, the goal of today's episode is not to romanticize or to condemn resistance, but it's simply so we can understand it better within its proper political and material context. So to start off with, you know, what is violence, I suppose, is a perfect starting point. Now, you know, very often the concept of violence is treated as something that is self-evident, but it is in reality shaped by power. Definitions of what constitutes violence and what doesn't are not neutral or universally agreed upon. They are produced through law, through media, through education, through our cultural norms that we live under, and they very often tend to reflect the interests of those who hold institutional authority. Now, in places like, you know, so-called Australia and in other settler colonies around the world, violence is commonly understood as the deliberate infliction of physical harm, especially in interpersonal or criminal context. Now, this narrow definition excludes broader forms of harm that are systemic, that are ongoing, and that are very much structural in nature. As a result, you know, acts like rioting, like property damage, or, you know, even stuff like armed resistance itself, are very easily categorized as violent, while the policies that lead to premature death, that lead to dispossession, and that cause all forms of social harm, they're not categorized as violent. Now, this distinction that exists here serves a political function. It serves the colony. It enables states to frame their own actions, including those actions that cause widespread suffering. It allows the state to frame these actions as lawful, as necessary, or as benign, while very much portraying acts of resistance and self-defense as irrational, as criminal, or as dangerous. Now, you know, an example of this is the police. You know, the use of police force during a protest may be presented as a response to violence, even if the protest itself is reacting to centuries of dispossession, of abuse, and of neglect. Now, it's very crucial to understand here that this framing conceals the violence that is embedded in everyday functioning of colonial states. Now, this framing, you know, does not recognize that denying a population things like access to adequate housing, healthcare, or education can and does produce harm that is just as real as physical assault. It also doesn't acknowledge that stuff like incarceration, surveillance, or forced child removals can and does cause intergenerational trauma that is deeply violent in effect, even if carried out through, you know, so-called legal or bureaucratic means. Violence, therefore, must be understood not only in terms of immediate actions, but also in terms of systems and outcomes. Structural violence refers to forms of harm that are built into political, economic, and social systems. And, you know, this includes stuff like poverty, racism, stuff like land dispossession and cultural suppression. And these forms of violence are often invisible to those who do not experience them directly. But at the end of the day, they are constant, they are cumulative, and they are deeply, deeply damaging. Recognizing this broader definition is absolutely essential to understanding what violence actually is, because without it, conversations about stuff like resistance and self-defense remain very much distorted, and it becomes possible to condemn the reaction without acknowledging the cause. A more accurate understanding of violence requires that we examine not only who acts, but also what conditions make those actions necessary in the first place. Now, I want to talk a bit about the everyday violence of colonialism. So, you know, colonialism is something that is often imagined as a historical event, but for First Nations people in so-called Australia and right around the world, it is not just some historical event. it is very much an ongoing structure. The effects of colonization are not limited to the initial acts of invasion and of dispossession. They persist daily through stuff like institutions, through policies, and through systems that continue to produce harm. Now, this harm is not always visible or spectacular, but it is very much consistent. It is very cumulative, and frequently it is actually quite lethal in its outcomes. Now, one of the most visible expressions of colonial violence in Australia today is our disproportionate incarceration. You know, despite making up just over 3% of the national population, and in fact, you know, you speak to a lot of blackfellas and we actually say it's under 3%, once you get rid of all the Johnny-come-latelys and false claimers and whatever else. But, you know, let's just say we're 3% of the population, right? But despite that, we're nearly one-third of the prison population. And in some jurisdictions, like if you look at juvenile justice up in the NT, for example, on any given day, we're anywhere from 95% to 100% of the incarcerated population for that demographic. You know, 3% of the population nationally, but in some places up to 100% of the population that are locked up. Now, if you were tuning in last week, you might have heard I spoke a little bit about this. In particular, about comparing our incarceration rates to South Africa's incarceration rates under apartheid. And the absolutely disgusting truth is that here in so-called Australia, today in the 21st century, 2025, blackfellas are locked up at 6.8 times the rate that black people in South Africa are locked up at the height of apartheid. 6.8 times as many. That's, you know, that right there is an act of violence that most people don't see as an act of violence. But mass detainment is violence. And that's what we're facing. You know, we have the highest incarceration rates in the entire world. And there's not even a million of us here. Quite a lot of us are, you know, locked up. I think, well, here's another, you know, damning statistic for you. Black fellas are more likely to see the inside of a prison cell than they are to graduate from high school. You know, that's the reality that we live under. And that right there is violence that is, you know, hidden from the eyes of everyday, ordinary Australians. You know, that right there is violence that is not acknowledged as violence. But locking someone up in a cage is a violent act. Now, these outcomes, they're not just a result of, you know, higher rates of criminal behaviour, but of they're actually the results of, you know, stuff like policing practices, of judicial bias, of socioeconomic marginalisation, all of which are legacies of colonial occupation. Now, similarly, the forced removal of Aboriginal children from our families remains a very ongoing crisis. And, you know, although the stolen generations are often framed as past injustice, and, you know, something that ended in 69 or the 70s or whatever, the truth and the reality is the rate of Indigenous child removal today exceeds that of any previous period in Australian history. Many of these removals occur under the justification, well, actually most of them occur under the justification of so-called neglect. But this is just a term that is often applied to conditions created by poverty and systemic disadvantage. And, you know, rather than addressing the root causes, the state continues to intervene in ways that fracture our families and fracture our communities. Again, this is an act of violence. Ripping a child away from their parents is a violent act. You know, ripping families apart, taking kids out of community, these are violent acts. And, you know, that's before we even touch on the fact that quite a lot of our kids who are taken from their families and who are put into, you know, homes or foster care or whatever else, often face abuse within these situations as well at the hands of non-Indigenous Australians. Now, there's a whole bunch of other things we could definitely touch on here. You know, I won't go too much into each thing. I'm hoping you're starting to get the gist of what I'm talking about here. But, you know, there's other stuff as well, like our health disparities. For so many different diseases and illnesses and conditions, we have some of, if not the worst stats in the entire world. I mean, look at our suicide, for example. We've got the highest suicide rate in the world. But you go back only 50, 60 years, the Aboriginal suicide rate was non-existent. If you go back prior to colonization, suicide was so foreign to our people that we didn't even have a word for it. You know, hundreds of languages across this continent, and I'm not aware of a single one that had a word for suicide because it was so alien and foreign to our existence. Yet today, we've got the highest suicide rates in the entire world, and especially for our youth. You know, our youth suicide rates are through the roof. And these suicide rates exist as a direct outcome of the structures that we live under, of the way that this society manipulates us and the way that this society polices us and tears apart our families and destroys our cultural identities and all of these other things it does to us. And, you know, that's just our suicide rate. You know, not to mention the fact that, you know, we die on average, what, a decade younger than anyone else in Australia. And the fact that we've got, you know, the world's highest rates for all these different diseases and illnesses. All of this, again, is a direct response of the system and of policies and laws and the way that these institutions are structured. You know, they're not accidents. They're not incidental outcomes or, you know, they're not byproducts of the system. This is the system operating as it's designed. You know, there's all these other things as well, like the cultural violence, like the economic and spatial displacement that we suffer. You know, for in terms of racial groups, we've got the highest homeless rates in the world. Highest in the world. And we don't have big diasporas overseas. All of our mob, for the most part, you know, except for maybe a tiny little minority, but for the most part, most black fellas still live on this continent, still live in their homelands. Yeah, we've got the highest homeless rates in our own homelands. You know, again, or systemic violence. Now, these forms of violence are frequently dismissed as, you know, as I was saying, as unfortunate outcomes or as natural disparities, but they are neither accidental nor apolitical. They are produced and maintained by the state, often in accordance with the state's laws, and they serve a function, which is to uphold a social and economic order that is built on the continued dispossession of Indigenous peoples. They are, in every meaningful sense, acts of violence, and we need to recognise them as such.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
That was Own Backyard by Horace Rowe and Jimbla, which is a very fitting song, actually, for what we're talking about today, which is violence. Now, you know, if you've just tuned in, we're talking about, you know, how we define violence and what defines violence, and in particular, how so much of the violent acts of the colonial state are not labelled as violent in the first place, even though, you know, sometimes they're far more violent than any individual act of, you know, assault or whatever else could ever amount to. Now, again, you know, I just want to highlight here that the purpose of this episode is not to condone or condemn or romanticise or, you know, et cetera, acts of violence. It's just simply to have a conversation about it where we define it accurately for what it is so we can understand it better. Now, just before the song, you know, we were talking a bit about what defines violence. Building on that, you know, I want to talk a bit about the myth of peaceful colonial rule. So, you know, here in so-called Australia, the narrative is, you know, Australia is this peaceful, law-abiding democracy, and that this democracy is a central feature of its national identity, along with, you know, how peaceful it is. Now, this image is something that is reinforced through our education systems, through media, through political rhetoric, and, you know, it often portrays the state as a civil and stable society that is committed to fairness, order, and human rights. Now, within this framework, colonialism is either downplayed as some regrettable episode of the past, or it's reframed as a process of settlement and development. The violence that enabled and continues to underpin this state is obscured, or it's outright denied. Now, the reality, though, is that Australia, the Australian state, was established through war, through forced removals, through massacres, and through cultural destruction. From the very moment of invasion, right back in 1788, in fact, even earlier, you know, when Cook first came here in 1770, colonial authorities and, you know, various different settlers have engaged in campaigns of military and paramilitary violence that has been designed to displace, to subdue, or to outright eliminate First Nations peoples. Now, these included officially sanctioned operations as well, such as the Black Wars down in Tasmania, as well as stuff like the widespread and systematic frontier killings that happened right across this continent. While many of these acts were, you know, once openly celebrated, they are now often omitted from public discourse, or they're treated as unfortunate but isolated events. Now, despite increasing public recognition of this history, the idea that modern Australia is no longer a violent settler state continues to persist, but this idea is wrong. This belief relies on a strict distinction between past and present, suggesting that these injustices of colonization, you know, all of these acts of harm that I just mentioned, it suggests that these have been resolved through stuff like legal reforms, through reconciliation programs, through inclusion within the political system. But at the end of the day, this distinction ignores the continuity of colonial structures and the ways in which they continue to generate harm for our people. Now, you've got a lot of contemporary institutions, stuff like the police, the prison systems, child protection systems, even the resource extraction industries. These contemporary institutions continue to operate in ways that prioritize state and corporate interests over Indigenous rights, over our well-being, and over our autonomy, sovereignty, and our self-determination. These systems, rather than breaking from their colonial past, actually represent its modern incarnation. They function to maintain settler sovereignty over stolen land and to suppress resistance, often through methods that inflict long-term harm to our people. Now, the presentation of the state as peaceful also very much relies on a narrow definition of violence, one that excludes stuff like structural violence, institutional violence, and environmental violence. Now, this presentation, it very much allows for the denial of responsibility for the conditions that cause our suffering, while at the same time legitimizing the colonial state's actions. Actions that include the use of force, and they legitimize them as, you know, necessary for public order. And within this understanding, we can see that resistance is actually cast as disruption, and that self-defense is something that is portrayed as aggression. This myth, at the end of the day, though, it serves a political purpose, and that purpose is to protect the legitimacy of the state by casting it as something that is neutral and benevolent, rather than as something that is a beneficiary of ongoing dispossession. Now, what else it does stuff like discourages solidarity with Indigenous struggles by, you know, framing our struggles as something that is a threat to peace rather than a response to violence. And it very much obscures the historical and material basis of resistance movements by treating them as moral or emotional overreactions rather than something that is grounded in a response to our lived experiences. Now, by understanding the persistence of this myth, at the end of the day, like, understanding this myth is very critical to our understanding, because without it, the state would have to contend with the reality that it continues today to rely on force and to rely on violence whether that force and violence is overt or structural, it still has to rely on it to maintain its authority. Exposing this myth opens the door to reframing resistance as something that is, you know, not as dangerous or as unlawful, but reframing it to something that is actually rational and historically grounded within our lived experiences, as well as our assertions of stuff like sovereignty, of our survival, and of our dignity at the end of the day. So for this next part, I want to talk a bit about, you know, the reframing of this responsive violence to self-defense, in particular, revolutionary self-defense. Because, you know, in the context of all of this ongoing colonial violence that is continuing to happen, the concept of revolutionary self-defense is something that we can understand to refer to the collective rights of oppressed people to protect themselves, to protect their communities and their lands and their cultures from all of these imposed systems of harm. Now, unlike conventional notions of self-defense, which are, you know, very often typically limited to immediate threats of physical violence, revolutionary self-defense is something that responds to structural and institutional aggression that is constant, that is legalized, and that is deeply embedded in the foundations of the colonial state. Now, for colonized and occupied peoples right around the world, including First Nations communities here in so-called Australia, acts of self-defense have historically included a wide range of strategies. You know, in the past, we had stuff like armed resistance during the frontier wars. We've, you know, had stuff like the establishment, well, not so much here, but elsewhere for First Nations people, the establishment of stuff like independent political and legal institutions. There's been stuff like community patrols to protect against police violence. In particular, you know, the Black Panthers done a lot of that sort of stuff. And there has been direct action to defend land and water and resources from extractive industries. Now, these responses emerge not from ideology alone, but they actually emerge from lived experience and from lived necessity. At the end of the day, you know, they are attempts to survive within systems that have repeatedly proven themselves to be hostile to Indigenous existence. Now, you know, while some forms of violence and, sorry, while some forms of resistance are non-violent, others have involved the use of force in the past or the disruption of settler infrastructure. Now, in these cases, revolutionary self-defense does not arise from a desire for violence, but instead it always arises from an absence of viable alternatives. And that is what we need to understand here. When we're talking about revolutionary self-defense, we're not talking about a want or a desire to go out and commit acts of violence ourselves. We're actually talking about having to respond to the violence against us when there is no other viable alternatives. There's nothing else that can be done to stop this ongoing violence against us. So, you know, when peaceful protest, for example, is ignored, and when legal avenues are exhausted, and when the state refuses to even acknowledge the harm it's doing, in the past around the world, we've seen that resistance often escalates. Now, understanding this escalation requires us to recognize the imbalances of power that exist. These imbalances are the way that the state has a monopoly on violence, yet it frequently condemns marginalized communities for daring to defend themselves against this state monopoly of violence. Again, you know, when we're looking at this in an international lens, we see that international liberation movements have, you know, forever articulated the legitimacy of revolutionary self-defense. In particular, you know, there's quite a lot of authors that speak about this. France Fanon is one. In Fanon's writing, you know, in the context of, he wrote a lot about revolutionary self-defense in the context of anti-colonial struggles in Algeria. And he argued that decolonization is inherently a violent process because the colonial system itself was born and continues to be maintained through violence. We have people like Amilcar Cabral as well speak about this quite often. If you don't know who he was a leader of the independence movement in Guinea-Bissau. He framed armed resistance as something that was necessary. It was necessary means to achieve self-determination because, again, you know, all of the peaceful methods had been tried and they had been denied and they had been exhausted to their ends. Now, you know, these thinkers, as well as many others, you know, at no point did they actually glorify violence, but instead they acknowledged that under conditions of structural domination, the refusal to submit it can itself be a form of self-defense and is quite often framed as violent in itself by the colonial powers. Now, when we look here in the Australian context, state violence is something that is often framed as being protective. You know, the whole upholding law and order nonsense that we hear. While resistance is something that is always framed as criminal, as, you know, extremist, as terrorism, as, you know, all of these other horrible things. But at the end of the day, we need to understand that this framing conceals the reality that First Nations people are not simply reacting to isolated injustices, but instead are reacting to a system that has produced generation after generation of cumulative harm. That's the reality that we live in. Now, whether through community-led initiatives, through cultural revival, through land defense, or through direct confrontation with state forces, acts of self-defense are attempts for people to reclaim space, to reclaim safety, to uphold their sovereignty, and to do all of this within a hostile environment. It's also important to distinguish revolutionary self-defense from stuff like retribution or indiscriminate violence. They're not the same thing, and we have to make that distinction as well. You know, the goal of revolutionary self-defense is not to harm for the sake of harm, but instead to interrupt cycles of dispossession and to actually prevent further ongoing suffering for ourselves and for the next generations that are, you know, going to come after us. At the end of the day, what it is a strategic response that is rooted in care for community and care for future generations. It's not something that is, you know, destruction for its own sake. Now, when we actually see stuff in this light, we see that revolutionary self-defense is not a threat to peace, but instead it's a prerequisite for it. It's a prerequisite for peace and for justice. If you're just tuned in, you are listening to Yilliman on 3CR, 855M, your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. And today we've been talking a bit about violence, in particular, you know, how we define violence and what we see and don't see as violent acts, especially in the context of stuff like self-defense against violent institutions such as the colonial state. Now, for the next bit, I want to talk a little bit about the double standards that exist and about the way that resistance is criminalized. So, you know, one of the most enduring features of colonial power is its ability to continually reframe itself as something that is legitimate, rational, and non-violent, even while it's out there, you know, undertaking and carrying out acts of systemic harm and systemic violence. Now, this framing is something that is reinforced through the colony's legal systems. It's reinforced through things like media narratives, through education systems, through public institutions. You know, all of these institutions and all of these different angles work together to criminalize resistance while normalizing the violence that the state undertakes every single day. Now, the inevitable result of this whole, you know, profound double standard that exists in how violence is actually understood, you know, on who is deemed dangerous and on whose actions are framed as justified actions. Now, again, in settler colonies like Australia, this double standard plays out across every level of our public discourse. When the state uses force, Now, whether this is through, you know, police operations, child removal, imprisonment, impoverishment, or land dispossession, etc., all these things I mentioned earlier. When the state uses this force, it is presented as a neutral or necessary act that is being carried out in the interests of public order or social welfare. Now, these actions are often accompanied by legal justifications and by media framing that portrays them as unfortunate but unavoidable and necessary. Now, by contrast, when First Nations people resist, again, you know, whether this is through protest, whether it's through direct action, whether it's through cultural assertion, or whether it's through our historic acts of armed resistance, they are portrayed as disruptive, they're portrayed as criminal, and they are portrayed as violent. Now, this holds true even when that resistance is actually something that is peaceful or symbolic. At the end of the day, you know, you go and look at Sky News, and not just Sky News, not just those right-wing news, but even like the more apolitical or centrist news outlets, you go and look at the way that they report on a peaceful protest or some symbolic act, and it's very much, even if they don't use the word violent, it's very much portrayed in the framing of being something that is violent and disruptive. You know, the occupation of public space as well, and the refusal to comply with state authority, the defense of our sacred sites, you know, all of these things are frequently met with condemnation, they're met with increased state surveillance, and they're met with criminal charges. The response is not proportionate to the act itself, but the response, I'm talking about the response to the state here, you know, the state's response is not proportionate to the act itself, but instead, we need to understand that it's proportionate to the challenge that it poses to the authority of the state. This disparity that exists is not something that is accidental. Instead, it reflects a broader effort to delegitimize Indigenous political agency, to suppress any form of resistance that threatens settler control. That's why it exists. You know, criminalization, at the end of the day, ends up becoming a tool of governance. It allows the state to frame Indigenous people not as political actors who have legitimate grievances, but instead to frame them as lawbreakers, as troublemakers, or as threats to national security. Now, this framing has material consequences as well, including imprisonment, fines, you know, community disruption, the tearing apart of our families. But as well as that, it also very much shapes public opinion. And, you know, when people hear about this violent framing of Indigenous resistance and protest and whatever else, and they hear about it as a violent framing, what it ends up doing is undermining support for Indigenous struggles. Now, we have to understand here that the language that is used to describe resistance is very central to this process. You know, when they use terms like riot, like vandalism, like public nuisance, you know, these are applied to acts of protest unfairly, while stuff like, you know, development and protection and law enforcement are terms that are applied to state actions that are actually causing the lasting harm. And this isn't accidental. This choice of language shapes the perception of the masses. You know, it draws a sharp line between what is considered to be acceptable and what is not acceptable. And in this light, resistance is cast as irrational, it's cast as reactive, while the structures that are being resisted are cast as something that is stable and justified. But, you know, these patterns aren't unique just to here in Australia. We find them happening right around the world. You know, right around the world, everywhere we look, Indigenous people and colonized people and occupied people are subjected to similar forms of criminalization by their colonial or occupying powers. You know, look at the US, for example. You know, in the US, the FBI's COINTEL program targeted Black, Indigenous, and anti-colonial activists and treated them as the these internal threats. In places like Canada, you know, land defenders who have been resisting gas pipelines and fracking and mining and whatever else, you know, these land defenders are subject to mass arrests, they're subject to mass surveillance. And, you know, when we look at all of these cases, the aim is the exact same. And that aim is to maintain control by discrediting and neutralizing any form of resistance against occupation, colonization, and extraction. Now, these are double standards that we have to understand. Understanding these double standards is essential to any honest discussion that we have about this stuff, you know, stuff like violence and self-defense, because without this context, it becomes very easy to suddenly condemn resistance without acknowledging what it is actually resisting. By reversing the roles of aggressor and defender, the state does stuff like, you know, protects its own legitimacy while denying the legitimacy of those who are actually challenging the harm that they're perpetuating. You know, we have to recognize these patterns. Recognizing these patterns is, you know, it's not justification for all forms of resistance, don't get me wrong, but it's a necessary step in understanding why they occur in the first place and why they are misrepresented by the occupying powers. I've only got about 8 minutes, or actually about 7 minutes left, so I just want to, you know, try and wrap it up a bit. But, you know, I suppose in conclusion, you know, violence is not something that begins with resistance. Violence begins with dispossession. It begins with deprivation. It begins with the denial of the right to exist on our own terms. You know, these are the acts of initial violence. And for colonized peoples, the conditions that are so often described as, you know, social disadvantage or inequality, they're not incidental. These are produced and maintained by systems of power that are designed to secure our land, steal our resources, and, you know, authorities that exist to benefit others, not the working class, let alone Indigenous people, you know, authorities that exist to benefit the ruling capitalist class. Now, within this context, you know, we understand that resistance is, you know, resistance cannot be understood as some isolated thing that is, you know, removed from the forces that actually make it necessary in the first place. Throughout history, First Nations people right across the world have resisted colonial violence in many forms. You know, as I touched on earlier, whether that's through culture, whether it's through protest, whether it's through legal challenges, armed struggle, community defense, etc., etc. And all the time, these acts have been criminalized, they've been discredited, they've been pathologized even, but they remain rooted in the simple truth, which is survival under occupation requires active resistance. The refusal of Indigenous people to be erased, to be displaced or assimilated is not a threat to peace, but it's a prerequisite for it, and it's a demand for justice, and that's the context that we have to understand it in. If you have been listening today, if you've, you know, made it to this far with me, you know, I really encourage you to critically re-examine the dominant definitions of violence that exist within yourself and that you hear within the mainstream media and from our mainstream colonial institutions and wherever else. Because when violence is only understood as something that is a physical confrontation between two people or, you know, law breaking, etc., etc., what ends up happening is entire systems of structural harm go, you know, they go unquestioned and they go unnoticed. You know, again, as I touched on earlier, the violence of child removal, of incarceration, of premature death, of, you know, cultural destruction, it must all be recognized for what it is instead of just seen as some background condition or some unfortunate byproduct. You know, we have to recognize them for what they are, which is deliberate outcomes of a broader colonial project. And once we do this, you know, once these forms of violence are actually acknowledged, we actually see that the legitimacy of revolutionary self-defense becomes a lot more clearer. Because, you know, as it stands, quite often it is framed as some sort of aberration, when in reality it is actually quite a rational and often necessary response to the violence that people live under. Now, again, I've said this a few times, I just want to say it again. You know, I'm not talking about this stuff to condone or romanticize revolutionary self-defense, or, you know, to condone or romanticize violence itself. And I'm not talking about it to condemn resistance and violence either. It's just that we have to have these conversations to better understand the systems that we live under, and to better understand the society and the way that it operates, and to better understand the harm that is very much ongoing to First Nations people, not just here in so-called Australia, but to, you know, First Nations people right across the colonized world, as well as, you know, people in the global south who are living under imperialism, who are living under occupation and extraction and et cetera, et cetera. Because at the end of the day, by understanding the true nature of violence, you know, who enacts it, who experiences it, who benefits from it, and who benefits from its denial, we can actually begin to see that resistance is not something that is a disruption of peace, but it's a struggle to create the possibility of peace and the possibility of justice in the future. You're listening to 3CR, 855M your dial, 3cr.org.au, streamed online and via the playback service. You can also listen via the iHeart Community Radio app, and you can listen to episodes like this and to past episodes. You can listen back to them wherever you might find your podcast, whether that be Spotify, Apple Music, you know, any of these other big podcasting websites. All of this stuff is up on there. It gets uploaded up there pretty regularly. And yeah, jump on there, listen to old episodes as well, because this isn't the first time we've talked about this. We have talked about it. It's the first time that we've, you know, directly addressed it in the way that we have today. But we've talked about quite a lot of these acts of state violence and colonial violence through a lot of my past episodes of Yilliman. Another really great place to listen and to learn a bit lot more about this sort of stuff is on Uncle Robbie's program, which is on just before mine from 11 to 12, Bundrel's Fire. And again, just like this program, you can find it on the website, freecr.org.au. You can also listen back to older episodes there, as well as places like Spotify, iTunes, etc., etc. I'll be back again next week to yarn about something else. But, you know, all this stuff's connected at the end of the day. But, yeah, I'll be back again next week. Until then, you're listening to 3CR. Don't go anywhere. Coming up next, we've got DJ Curly with Cultural Kinetics, which is a really great program. And if you've been listening to all the heavy stuff we've been talking about today, it's especially a great program to stay tuned to. It's going to be taking you through for the next hour with some deadly beats, you know, lift your spirits back up again and, you know, make you feel a bit better again for the rest of your day. I'll be back again next week. Until then, have a good one.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.